Hello, I'm Johnny, I'm your host, welcome to the show. I'd like to thank you for listening. I have a great show for you today. My guest is author and district attorney Mark Pryor. He's from here in Austin. He's got a new book out called The Crypt Thief, but we will get to that in a minute. First of all, I need to make a very important announcement. We have a live podcast coming up next Monday, May 13th in Austin, Texas, at the Saxon Pub at 7 p.m. My guest will be the Edison Chair, the band here in Austin. Just put out a record produced by my friend Matt Nevesky. From Blue October, and also David Cotton will be a guest. He's an Austin treasure, guy with great stories, was one of Kinnison's best friends, has been in the scene for a long time and books a lot of clubs. Be interesting to hear his story. And so come out, support us, 7 p.m. at the Saxon Pub, Austin, Texas, Monday, May 13th. All right, do that. I actually just played this last Monday at the Saxon Pub at 7 p.m. opening for Bob Schneider. It was a good show. And had some friends come out. Even the guest today, Mark Pryor and his wife Sarah, came out. That was cool to see them. They came out on the eve of the release of his new book. And so that went down. I have also encountered some serious technical difficulties here in the studio. And this is why this show is a little late, if you were expecting it on Tuesday. If not, you know, probably you don't care about that. So anyway, I did have a CD burner break, and I've been kind of under the gun doing a lot of rehearsing for a big Skyrocket show we have this weekend at the Paramount Theater here. And yeah, we got a horn section and everything, doing a bunch of new songs. And we also have a show Friday at Hanover's. I think that's the 10th or 11th Friday, May. In Austin, if you're here, come on out, see the Skyrocket, do that. And don't forget, man, come on out to the live podcast. Should be fun. Edison Chair, David Cotton, Saxon Pub, 7 p.m., Monday, May 13th. All right. My guest today is author and assistant district attorney / blogger, Mark Pryor. Mark Pryor just put out his third book. It's his second book of fiction. It's called The Crypt Thief. It came out this week on Tuesday, so you can get it anywhere, Amazon, bookstores, if they're still available at bookstores. You can download it for your Kindle, and hopefully the audiobook is coming soon. Anyway, Mark and I became friends through a very strange situation. He was the lead prosecutor on my mom's murder trial, which ended up in a success. And I liked him from the get-go. We talk about it, how we kind of ended up getting along. We're relatively the same age. We're both creative guys. He's got a beautiful family, and he's just a great guy. And he's put out his third book this year since October. This week. So that's pretty exciting. He wrote a book about my mom's trial and case called As She Lay Sleeping, I think. And then his first book was called The Bookseller, which is related to this book, The Crypt Thief. So anyway, I'm not going to hold you back any longer. This is a great conversation. It's a guy that I really like a lot, obviously. But I also like him. Like if we hadn't gone through that thing, I think we would still be friends. I like him a lot. His name's Mark Pryor, and here's my conversation with him. I hope you enjoy it. I did.
Thank you.
I think trials would be far cooler if when the prosecution walked in, they played that tune. Your papers together?
I don't think the defense would like that too much.
No. Maybe they could have their own music.
What would that be?
The Banana Splits theme song.
I'm going to suggest that next time I have a trial.
If you guys ever need suggestions, is there a suggestion box there at the courthouse? I didn't notice one.
No, I don't think there is. I don't remember seeing one.
No. Hey, when does The Crypt Thief come out?
The Crypt Thief, I think, comes out May 7th, so just the day before my birthday.
Oh, your birthday is Wednesday?
Yes.
Are you guys coming to see me for your birthday, or is it just a night out?
Just a night out.
Okay.
Yeah.
I might have to wish you happy birthday from the stage.
Thank you.
And your book comes out the night? How exciting. So I've got three books in my hand. Two of them are together, but I like that. It's pretty cool that they match.
Yeah, you know? I wonder if I write 15 or 20, if the black and white might get a little bit old, but...
No, I think that would be cool, man. You'd always know your Hugo Marston novels.
Yeah, I think that's the idea, the consistent theme. The third one that comes out at the end of the year is the same theme, and it has a very cool old chateau. Just the kind of house that you look at it and you think sort of, you know, people like were killed and made love and
yeah.
It's a lot of history to it. So it's the third one. It's got a really cool cover.
So where are you at? You've put out three books in 1 year. You did. Yeah. How much did you write in the last year?
I've written a lot in the last year, but mostly the Crypt Thief, the one that's just coming out. Yeah. That's the one I was writing the most. The other three books, like The Bookseller, the one that's come out in December is the one that I've been writing the most. It's called The Blood Promise. Because the Bookseller and The Crypt Thief I pretty much had written by the time I had a book deal.
Okay.
So I had to do some editing of them. And then obviously I had to finish the True Crime as She Lay Sleeping.
Yeah.
In fairly short order at the end of last year. But yeah, it's been busy. I mean, every weekend I'm tapping away down at the library.
Do you still ride around with cops on Thursdays?
Pretty much every Thursday, yeah. I was out.
What is that? What is that like?
It depends. Like the Thursday we just had, it was unbelievably quiet. We went to the 12th and Chicon, which is, you know, if you want your crack or a crack whore, that's the place to be. But we just sat there, and we sat there in the little alley waiting for something to happen, and, you know, a couple of old Chris Packets went cartwheeling by, and you know, one dude sort of gave us a wave as it was just cold, you know, it was cold and windy, and we tried to set up on this spot where my officer was telling me, oh, we'll get people speeding here, I get them all the time, and we were there 20 minutes, and everybody was obeying the law, and he kept apologizing, saying, sorry, it's so boring.
Sorry, no one's breaking the law.
But, you know, then again, I've been out when an officer had to shoot somebody. So, that was.
What do you do in that? Like, do you call somebody for help, or do you get involved in any way? What do you just like?
On that one, we arrived. The call had come out, shots fired, and we knew there was an officer in trouble.
Right.
So we come racing up to the scene, and we get there. We're number, I think, the third car there. Including the officer, and so nobody really knows what's going on. And so my driver, my guy, he's not really my driver. But my
what a great way to look at it!
My chauffeur says to me, he tells me to stay put because you know there's gunplay and no one knows what's going on. But man, I can't help it. I just can't help it. So I get out of the car and follow along behind him, and then I look down and there's an officer who's leaning with his back against a mailbox, looking like crap. And then to my left, and then to my right, in somebody's front yard, there's a dead guy. And so, at which point, I'm thinking, yeah, maybe I should have stayed in the car. but it's wild.
God, it can be intense. So then, what's the purpose of you doing that? Like to get your office in touch with the street?
Yeah, I think because mostly the cops on the street have no idea. They don't deal with us unless they're summoned to testify.
Right.
And then it's a very sort of business-like interaction. They don't get feedback. They don't get to know us.
Right.
And we don't really get to know them. So this way, you know, if an officer on the street, because I've been riding out with the same guys now for over a year, most of them have my phone number. So if they get into a situation where they want to know, can they search this? Can they seize that?
Oh, that's good.
And certainly the sergeant has called me several times. at home on the weekend to run something by me. So it's definitely, it's for that whole liaison thing, it's very useful.
Yeah, that's important.
But they, you know, one time they drove me to a crime scene. They had two women in separate police cars who had been stealing stuff and hoarding it in their apartment. And their roommate had called them in, and so they weren't sure whether they could search it, and they couldn't.
Right.
But the sergeant just had me stand on the sidewalk looking tough, which is very hard for an Englishman to do, by the way.
No, but you're a big dude.
Yeah. So he had me standing there looking tough, and he went over to each suspect in turn and started pointing at me and saying, "That's the DA, that's the DA, he's here in your case, you better start talking before your friend does, otherwise you're going to get in big trouble."
How's he going to be bad cop?
And so, just by standing there.
Yeah.
I don't think I could do it in person, and so both women spilled their guts immediately and didn't have to search the place in the end. So,
wow,
I'm at my most useful when I'm saying nothing.
Are you just so busy all the time? I mean, you have three children, a wife, and an exploding literary career, and also a DA.
Yeah, and I play soccer on Sundays.
And you play soccer on Sundays. Well, you got to do something.
I know, right? I don't feel like I ever get any time just to do absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
Maybe in the evenings, you know, for an hour.
Yeah.
I'll sit and veg out and watch TV with my wife, but...
What do you watch when you do that? Law and Order?
No. Well, not far off. Actually, we watch... what do we watch? We like The Simpsons a lot. We always watch The Simpsons.
Yeah.
And then there's a couple of shows we watch, like Dexter.
Yeah.
Like, because I don't get enough crime.
Yeah.
House Hunters International. That's for when I get, you know, millions of dollars for my next book deal and get to buy that chateau in Paris.
Well, you very well might. When they say that they get these Oprah things, are you in the Oprah Book Club?
I'm in her... their email, she has a listserv with like a couple million people on it, like recommendations she sends out. So I was on that. There's no, well, I guess she doesn't have a show anymore, but that wouldn't be any chance of me appearing on that, I don't think. So it was,
there'd be a great chance though, wouldn't there? I mean, just because of your job and because of Ashley Lay sleeping along with being this guy, you just have an interesting story.
Maybe I always imagine there's 50,000 people ahead of me in line that have equally interesting stories. I would go for sure.
Yeah.
But, I think she does more literary novels than crime fiction anyway, so.
Yeah. I remember that guy that went on there and lied, and then she made him come back on and apologize?
I would
do
that.
He wrote that book.
I would totally do that. If he gets me on the show twice, why wouldn't you?
That was the best part about it. I think so many people went and bought it after they found out he lied about it.
Yeah. Was he sorry?
I don't know.
I don't remember. I don't know if he was sorry, whether he kind of justified himself.
A Million Little Pieces, it was that guy.
James Frey.
Yeah. I didn't even know his name.
Yeah.
So this is an interesting thing because you were the prosecutor on my mom's murder case and you put away the dude that murdered her.
Yeah.
For a long time.
And I was just thinking on the way over about how we met. I don't know if you remember that. It was in the large conference room, which isn't very large, on the second floor of the DA's office. And you had your back to the window. And I was sitting there opposite you, trying to tell you how the whole thing worked, and while thinking, you know, feeling bad for you, and you sat there making jokes the whole time.
That's how I deal with it.
Well, exactly. And right then I thought, you know what? Even if this case is hard, this victim is going to be easy.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that we would become friends, but I always figured that we could be because...
You made jokes too, yeah. And so I felt comfortable like this. Here's a guy that gets it.
Yeah, sometimes they keep me away from victims.
Yeah,
for that very reason.
I can
because,
see that.
Yeah, you have to be careful.
Yeah, there was one time. I think one of the first times I talked to you, where you were frank about stuff, and it was I'd never really spoken to people that didn't show this amazing amount of empathy and sympathy for my, you know, for me. And empathy for my situation, right? And so I do remember being taken aback and then walking out and going like, wow, that's somebody's job. Like, that guy has another thing he probably has to go to now and talk to another dude that's in my same position about the same kind of thing. You know what I mean?
You didn't think I didn't care?
No, not at all. No, I was just like, whoa, I'd never heard anybody be frank like that.
Yeah, I mean, at that stage, we were looking, we didn't think we could win.
Yeah.
And a few stages later, too.
I do remember I remember one of the last times that I met with you guys before the trial, Efren was like, I don't know if we're going to win this one. I was trying to do a good Efren, but I can't.
Yeah, you have to swear a little bit more. Yeah.
That'd be awesome if he was just a swearing machine.
You never heard him swear?
I heard him swear when he said the note. When he read the note that Dennis left my mom.
Yeah, he's funny because he obviously in court he doesn't swear. When he's around his family he doesn't swear, but all day long.
it's like his little his release.
It is. That's exactly what it is. It's hilarious.
I knew a guy that was a carpenter that was like that. That, like, as soon as he had a hammer in his hand and his tool belt on, it was just, like, expletive city.
Yeah. Every defendant's a knucklehead.
Yeah.
And he swears like a sailor. It's fantastic.
Hey, let me ask you this. As far as cases go, and, I mean, we'll go through a lot of stuff, but let's get through this because it's sort of a thing that connects us, and we should probably talk about it.
All right. Do we need a therapist here?
No.
Okay.
No, I think we can handle it. I went on Tuesday. So I think the cast of characters involved in this case, like I know people might have seen the thing 48 Hours or the other show that I can't remember the name of.
Discovery ID.
Yeah, Discovery ID.
Yeah.
And or might have read the book. But like I was astonished at there were so many weird people. There was like a flasher.
Yeah.
That apparently I knew and then turned out to be a flasher.
Old. I don't know if we changed his name in the book.
You did in the book.
Okay, yeah. We won't call him that then.
No. I'll beep it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing about that whole case from start to finish was, and I tell people now when they ask, when I do interviews about, I did a radio one just the other day, Minneapolis, I don't know if you called it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And they ask about the book, because the radio interviews are ostensibly just about the As She Lay Sleeping, but they ask about the fiction too. And I tell people that if I had tried to write that as fiction,
you couldn't have gotten the people.
Well, it would have been people who would have been, you know what, this is just too unbelievable. I mean, the alibi witness digging her diary out of the attic.
Yeah, that was so weird.
And the fact that the police never even checked the ex-boyfriend's alibi.
Yeah.
That in itself, if I read that in a book, I'd throw it across the room.
Yeah.
But it's only when you get out of fiction and get into real life that you realize this stuff and these characters is crazy. I mean, again, I won't say his name in case we changed it, but the guy who...
You did change it.
Who admitted to being drunk.
Right.
But not so drunk that he couldn't drive home.
Oh. Oh, yeah.
I mean, it was like...
That guy was creepy, man.
Yeah.
Plus, there was a couple of guys that wrote me on Facebook after they went up on the thing and they were like, hey, maybe we should get together and hang out sometime. Just like, and do what?
Talk about how, like, you testified against me.
Yeah, what a jerk.
Wow.
Two dudes. Yeah, it was totally weird. I mean, what are we going to do?
I imagine, I know for me it was the most intense trial I've ever done. I mean, I had a capital murder case after that was nothing like as intense as yours.
What was so intense? I mean, because it was intense, and I can't judge it because I don't know anything else that I haven't just seen on TV, or it also happened to me, so there's this level of intensity that other people aren't dealing with, so I don't... It was intense.
But it was always going to be intense for you.
Right.
For me, it was... It was a whole bunch of things that all kind of came together. One was that, I mean, obviously, I'm a competitive guy. I wanted to win.
Yeah.
But it's not really, I mean, this DA stuff has never been about winning. It's always been about making sure that you get the right result. And in this case, that involved winning.
Yeah.
So there was that pressure and the fact that it was such a tough case. I mean, gosh, crazy.
It was so old. There was no evidence. There was nothing.
Yeah. Why don't I say that?
Well, no, I mean, but there wasn't no physical evidence. Things that you could just, you know, oh, this is it. We got it.
Yeah. And also, you know, I never knew how people were going to perform. And I mean, think about the people on the stand, even you. I didn't know how you were going to do on the stand. Or, you know, the alibi witness or some of the ladies that...
You gave me a good review in your book, on the stand.
I did?
Yeah, you actually used the word stoic.
Stoic.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Yeah. Anyway, go ahead.
Sorry. Yeah. So there was that pressure of every morning getting up, coming in, and just crossing fingers. I mean, if you think about some of the witnesses we had, that you know, the ex-girlfriend, Dennis's ex-girlfriend, who I knew was a stick of dynamite just waiting to go off. She just happened to go off in the right way for us, but it could have gone the other way.
So the wife? Lady?
No. Well, see, there was her as well.
Oh, yeah. But the other one.
Yeah, the one from out of state.
I can't remember if her name is the same or anything.
No, we changed her name.
Okay. She's very nice.
Yeah, very nice. And did a great job in the end, but I had no idea how any of these people were going to do. And so that's very stressful. Normally when I have a lot of cases, a lot of my witnesses are going to be cops or detectives or forensics people.
Yeah.
And
that main guy was dead.
Yeah. But all those cops, all those professionals, they know how to testify.
Yeah.
And even if they're idiots, you know what you're getting when they take the stand.
Right.
When you have so many lay witnesses coming in trying to remember stuff from 25 years ago, it's...
then also there was the people that you know, they were living the dream back then and partying down, and they didn't want to come out because now they're normal and they don't, you know...
Yeah, we had several people who just really didn't want to have anything to do with it for that exact reason. Yeah. So, and, you know, there was a lot of hubbub around it with the TV cameras there, and I felt like a lot of people at work were watching and see how it would go, because... couple other people didn't want to, you know, they'd sort of senior people had turned the case down, so
yeah.
Thank heavens we had Efren there as our rock.
Yeah, he's cool. You know, that you also made reference in there that there was times when I was okay and calm about things that some people might not be. Do you know what I'm talking about? Like I said, like, oh, we'll cross that bridge when we get to it and stuff like that. I had a lot of confidence in you because I knew that you wanted to win.
Well,
and it didn't seem like a bullshit confidence. It seemed like, you know what I mean? It didn't seem like you were scared in any way. You just really, like, you were honest about stuff, but you were like, you know, we can do this.
Yeah, that makes me think of my little boy when he plays soccer. He's smaller than most people.
Yeah.
But they play him at central back, which is the position where the big guy plays, because he's not afraid of anybody. He'll just go charging in and do his best. And that's kind of how I felt in this case. It was the first murder case I was ever assigned.
Yeah.
So I knew I was, in that sense, I was over my head, but I also knew that if I worked hard enough at it, it's no different than any other kind of case. You know, you line up your facts, you line up your witnesses, work with the defense as much as you can, and then trust the witnesses to do their job and trust the jury to do its job. So.
Yeah. I will say this one thing that I don't know if I've ever gotten to talk about it, but people should know. Like, my family's Cuban. These women are crazy. They cry at the drop of a hat. In fact, I'll tell you this. My grandma, this Christmas, the end of the whole Christmas experience, we're cleaning up after we opened presents and stuff. My grandmother, we'd all been there for like 2.5, 3 days. And my grandmother goes, I was so happy. Nobody threw up and nobody was crying. So at one point.
That's a good Christmas.
when we're coming in to do the, when they're coming in to read the verdict.
Yeah.
You turned around like just before they were about to do it and you said, don't react in any way. I was like, Jesus, do you know who I'm with?
That's a good point.
I'm with like the reaction sisters.
Yeah. And that's the hardest thing for me, just to sit there with a straight face, look serious no matter what.
Yeah.
Have
you ever been in a situation where you wanted to just go like, no, what?
Yes. Yeah. Not that I've lost many cases, but
right.
I tried a DWI case where we had the guy who was absolutely hammered, and it was on film, and everybody in the whole room knew he was drunk. Unfortunately, I had a bad police officer who'd said he'd done a bunch of these field sobriety tests that he hadn't done, and you could tell because it was on camera.
Yeah,
he hadn't done them, and so the jury found him not guilty to punish the police officer.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, and I sort of knew they were going to do that, but even so, I was a little frustrated.
Yeah.
And when I went back to talk to them, they told me that was the deal. And then one of them said to me, but that guy, he's not going to get away with it, is he? Driving drunk? I was like, well, he actually just did. But
ouch.
Yeah. You know, that and all my experience tell me that these jurors take their job so seriously. Yeah. And they really try, they really pay attention, and they do. For the main, a really good job, I think.
Yeah. I got summoned right after that.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, like 2 months or something after that.
Did you?
It was weird.
Did you go?
Yeah, I went. I said, I didn't say, I didn't even, I don't think I had to say anything. I went in and they, some guys said, I think it was going to be pretty gnarly. It was like a child molestation case.
Oh, yeah.
But somehow they excuse me. I just think I looked weird, you know?
Probably. Gotta wish. If you look weird, the prosecution will get rid of you. If you look weird, then the defense will keep you.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So.
Yeah, so I got nixed. So so let's go back. Where were you born? Obviously not here.
No, I was born in Hertfordshire in England, which is used to be a rural county right north of London.
Yeah.
I don't think it's rural much more. London and those other towns have spread pretty much across it. So that's where I was born and raised, on a farm, in fact.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Did you have chores, like outside chores, milking cows and getting the eggs? Did you have to go get the eggs?
You know, we did have chickens for a while, but I think the foxes got to them.
Yeah.
And I suspect that I probably pitched such a fit about doing chores that I'm not a very farmery kind of guy.
No, you don't seem farmer.
No, I'm not.
Yeah.
So I tell people I was born on a farm and they look at me like I'm kidding.
Did you go to like a small school? Was it like a rural kind of school?
You know, actually when I was 10 years old, I basically said to my parents, because I'm very social, I was bored out of my mind. So I said to my parents, you know, I need to go to boarding school. And so they found a boarding school for me, and 10 years old, that's where I went.
And where'd you go?
It was a place that's still up and running now. It has girls now, but it didn't when I was there. It's called Maidwell Hall. And it was, if you've ever seen movies involving prep schools, English boarding schools from years past, that's what it was like.
I've only seen Class, but that's an American boarding school.
There's a movie called If, which makes me think of what it was like. The food was good. The teachers were all, I suspect, too twisted to get jobs through the state, so they got jobs at private schools. We had one guy who was tall, thin, with black hair, and a little Hitler moustache. Which, if you think about it, you know, that's only 30 years after the war.
Yeah, yeah.
Nobody had those except for this guy.
Weird.
Mr. Flowers, I'll never forget him. But it was moderately barbaric, not overly.
Yeah. And so, what were you a good kid?
I was the kid who got other people into trouble. Who had the great idea for
that.
I had the great idea for the prank.
Right.
And I would assign roles.
Right.
And mine would be to stand on the sidelines and watch while they did it and or got caught.
Right. I'll supervise.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Hey, I had the idea. You do
prank
the work.
Prank supervisor, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And really, my whole life, I always pretty much got away with that.
Yeah. Did they have like a headmaster guy that was like in the movie The Wall or something?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
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 Like a disgruntled guy.
Yeah,
his
well,
wife
would
beat him.
I'll give you an example that we had little dormitories, and we had kids there who were lords and who knows what. We had the nephews of the Shah of Iran.
Oh, really?
And one night, I suggested to a couple of the other boys that they short sheet his bed. You know what that is, right?
Yeah.
And so I had the suggestion, and these two lads did it. And he comes in, and both of these boys, Reza and Muhammad were their names. They had just a temper like you would not believe. So this kid, Reza, gets in, finds he's been short-sheeted, flips out, grabs some nail scissors, and stabs one of the kids. Headmaster's walking outside. He hears the ruckus. He comes in and says, "What the bloody hell's going on?"
Yeah.
Drags everybody off to his study. Well, first thing he does, he says, who short-sheeted this bed? And I'm sitting on my bed thinking, technically I didn't do it.
Yeah.
So I didn't put my hand up.
In your Mansonian way.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Call me Chuck. And so the two boys who did it, they end up getting caned.
Right.
And the nephew of the Shah of Iran who did the stabbing, he got a very, very severe talking to.
Wow, because they had all the money.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's kind of the
there was a new Shah of Iran library that was built.
Like exactly, yeah, 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 precisely, yeah, the horse track.
So what did your parents do? What were they, what was their...
Well, my mom was just stayed at home and dad ran the farm. We had three men to help run the farm.
What was the farm
growing? We had wheat, barley. We had a few cows, but mostly because Dad liked to have them around.
Yeah.
But, you know, they ended up leaving the farm when I was in my early 20s, and they were in their 50s, I guess. Sort of a real heartbreaking moment, but it was one of those things that turned out for the best, because they ended up buying a house in the countryside and getting bored out of their minds. They're very, very active people. And they ended up signing up for the English version of the Peace Corps.
Oh, wow.
In their 50s, and went out to Africa for 3 years.
That's awesome.
Yeah, they lived in a little house with no. It had running water, but it was just cold water.
Yeah,
had no electricity, and they were showing these people how to be this sort of commune, how to be self-sufficient, planting things, raising chickens for eggs.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was frustrating for them to begin with. They taught. Because my dad would build stuff. He built a big chicken coop for them, and I'm trying to tell the story without sounding patronizing, but it's just a very different cultural experience. Because,
right.
And then they had their first batch of eggs, because you know the whole point was you get a chicken there and you kick it, you kill it, and then you cook it and you eat it, because
right.
they're quite sparse. But so Dad shows up with Mum and Dad show up with his chickens, and they say, all right, don't kill them, have eggs,
right.
You know, however long it takes to get the first batch of eggs. And everyone's very excited, and Mum and Dad, unfortunately, they were away when these eggs came. And the people who were living there were so excited at their first batch of eggs, they had a big celebration party in which they killed and cooked all the chickens. So it was a long... They were there for 2 years, and then they were asked to stay another year because it hadn't sunk in completely. So they did stay for that extra year. And,
wow.
Yeah. Yeah, that was crazy. I was very proud of them for doing that.
Do you think you'd ever do something like that?
I'm not...
Like, maybe you've done enough working in the DA's office.
I'm not practical enough. I mean, yeah. They had no hot water, so my dad just buys a huge, great big black pipe, attaches it to a cold tap,
mm-hmm.
and then drapes it all over the roof.
Yeah, so it heats up.
Yeah, I mean,
smart guy.
Yeah, well, see, I never would have thought of that.
Yeah.
I'd have been boiling small pots of water on my gas stove.
Right. You're a little too posh for that kind of job,
yeah,
aren't you?
Yeah,
you got off the farm too soon.
Yeah, I did.
So what did you were in school? Were you interested in journalism when you were in high school? Because that was your first thing, right?
Yeah, that was my first career.
Yeah,
but that was because
what was your dream then in high school?
I didn't have one.
You didn't?
I didn't want to do anything really. Not that I was inherently lazy, which I might be, but
right.
There was nothing that appealed to me. I've never been any good at doing something if I don't really want to do it.
Me too.
Yeah, you have to. I mean, and it's crazy because some people, and I think of millions of people across the world who do jobs and are happy to do jobs because it brings in money and they can raise their family. I can't do that.
Yeah, it's.
So there was nothing I wanted to do, and then my poor mum would come up with suggestions.
what would she say?
The best one was she signed me up to take the British Airways airline pilot tests.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and. I have a terrible spatial recognition, and I got lost on the way to the British Airways testing center. I was staying with my girlfriend, and I had the wrong shoes, and I was not dressed properly, and I didn't take it seriously from minute one. And I'm sure I did the worst score they've ever had.
Right.
And so the entire flying population needs to be very grateful.
Yeah,
that
everyone should be.
Didn't go out. And then, but then she suggested journalism. And then I thought, well, you know, journalists, they get to travel. And because that's what I like to do.
Right.
You know, I traveled a lot, some by myself when I was younger, came over to the States and did stuff. I think she probably pitched it as, you know, you get to travel and see exciting things.
Yeah, meet people.
Yeah. And so I ended up going to journalism school and actually really liking it. And that worked out very, very well for a few years.
What did you do? Tell me about that.
The journalism.
Where'd you work?
I worked on a weekly paper in the on the East Coast, crappy little town, really. With all due respect, I better not mention its name now.
Oh, you'd moved here?
No, this was back in England.
Oh, in the East Coast of England.
Yeah, East Coast of England. Yeah, sorry. And then I did that, and then I moved to the sort of main. That was the weekly paper, but there was the evening paper that was its mother paper, as it were. And I moved there, and I did I worked as their police reporter.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, and I'd always been interested in crime. That's one thing that always appealed to me. And I suppose it's lucky I didn't go into crime when I was young. But police report in England is not the same as it is here. I think I did it for a year and a half, and there wasn't a single murder. The only shooting we had that I remember was some idiot kid from London who came up and tried to hold up a gun store. And, okay. and guess what happened to him?
Yeah.
And that was the only real excitement we ever had as, you know, as a police reporter. And nothing like this. I mean, maybe we have too much violence over here, but from a reporting standpoint, it makes it more interesting at least. And then I did that. So I did that for a couple of years and then came over to travel with my then girlfriend, because my mother's from Chapel Hill.
Right.
So we ended up going there. We went out to visit my brother in Colorado, spent a few months being ski bums.
Yeah. Where in Colorado?
Aspen.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
The stars.
Yeah. Well, he's now chief of police there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, he's a very serious white guy by the name of Richard Pryor. who is chief of
Sorry,
police.
Just made me snot out of my nose.
I was saving that for that.
He's Richard Pryor? That is awesome.
Yeah.
So, you know, like the sheriff of Aspen, that was the guy that used to have to look after Hunter Thompson.
Yeah.
Did he ever know Hunter out there?
I don't know. I don't know. Because that was just outside the city limits in the Woody Creek area.
Okay. Whenever I had aspirations at all, and they were just fantasy level of being some kind of journalist in my late teens and early 20s, would be that kind of thing where you don't actually report on anything, you just go get wasted
and write dribble
a weird story, yeah, and people think it's funny.
Yeah. You have to do that at the end of your successful career.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's, you know, sad thing is I tell people that story, like when I write out now with the cops.
Yeah.
I tell them that.
Yeah.
And the usual reaction is, who's Richard Pryor? Because these guys are like, the guys I'm writing out with now are like 25, 26.
Oh, yeah.
And so they don't, I think I've heard of that guy. But mostly,
oh, that's weird.
I know, it messes up my story.
Yeah, totally does. So you went out and you hung out with him in Colorado, and what happened with the girlfriend?
Well, you know, that ended up not happening because I loved it so much. I loved this place so much. I decided to stay because I have dual citizenship. I could and she couldn't. So it was that was curtains for that.
Yeah. So what'd you do? Where'd you settle down?
I bounced around a little bit. So I was in Denver for a while. I was in Chapel Hill for a long time.
Chapel Hill's awesome.
It's great. Yeah.
So great. I love the Carolinas so much.
Yeah. And you know, I have a lot of family there. I spent a lot of time, cared for my grandfather when he got sick. That was my job for a little while. And then I just did some freelancing too, but they wouldn't give me a real job because I didn't have an American degree.
Oh.
So they said, you know, if you get a U.S. degree, then come back and apply. And so I thought, well, what choice do I have?
So where'd you go to school?
I went to UNC Chapel Hill.
Okay.
To journalism school.
Nice.
And when I was there, I was sort of, it was funny because I was thinking about going to law school and I got the best advice that anybody has ever given me. And I'm actually prepared to share that with you today.
Thank you. maybe I could use it.
Maybe. I was talking to my grandmother, this wise, you know, white-haired grandmother.
Yeah.
And I was saying to her, you know, and I was 28 or something, 27, 28 at the time, and I was saying, gosh, I'm 27, 28. I'm kind of old to be changing my career. I mean, if I go to journalism school and then law school, I'll be 32 by the time I get out. I mean, that's 5 years. I'll be 32 years old. And she looked at me. She goes, well, how old are you going to be in 5 years if you don't do all that? And I was just like, oh, my goodness.
Wow.
And I was like, sign me up.
Wow, what is it? Wise woman.
Yeah. You can be 32 with a law degree or 32 without one.
And so you went to school there?
I had to kind of cram it in. I did the undergrad bit in, well, because I went to them and I said, look, I've been a journalist for almost 10 years. And I have my British diploma, journalism diploma. What kind of credit will you give me? And they said, well, of the 120 hours, we'll give you 7.
Jeez.
Yeah. And I got mad and then I thought, well, you know, that's the way it works. I've got to do it.
Yeah.
So I did, that program in about 2.5 years. And then signed up, went through law school.
Were you going to school, working too, I mean?
I did, actually, yeah, I did.
What'd you do? I want to think of you like as a barista or like a pizza place or something.
I did a few things. I did, believe it or not, I had a friend who ran a bar. It was quite a nice bar, and I call myself a bouncer, but I really wasn't.
Yeah.
I was the guy at the front who checked people's IDs.
Yeah.
And it wasn't the kind of bar you ever have to throw anybody out of.
Yeah.
But that was a fun, I only did that probably 3 times.
Is that one of those places, Chapel Hill, is that one of those places where you have to buy a membership to go in? You know how those places in the Carolinas?
They do, yeah. But yeah. His place was like a bar restaurant, so you didn't have to.
Okay.
But they do have those, yeah. You have to buy a membership in order to get it.
What kind of law is that?
Something about drinking.
Okay.
It's related to drinking, I think. But I like that job because you would see people at 9 o'clock come in and they were very respectable and nice and polite. You'd see them 3 hours later. Yeah. And it was just hilarious. I mean, it was so much fun. And I was single too, so you know, it was.
So you're meeting ladies because you're the handsome guy at the door
with the accent.
Yeah. Oh my God. Especially there.
And
they're like, oh my God, right. What are you saying?
Yeah. And if they'd come from another bar and they show their ID and they're like 52 years old, and you're like, wait a minute, let me see your ID. You're not 21.
Yeah.
And they love that.
Look at you.
Yeah. It's.
You know, I have that same thing watching the people come in at 9 o'clock and leaving, stumbling later at Cedar Street.
I bet you do.
I literally can watch people fall apart.
Yeah.
Like their makeup.
That's not your music that does that, though.
No. No, it's the alcohol, definitely. Okay. There was a lady that was there. She was there with someone that just last week when we played. And, there was a lady flashing us, like lifting up her skirt and showing us her business downstairs.
She wasn't wearing anything?
She was wearing stuff, but she was like 50 or something. It was pretty weird.
Wow.
It was real weird. And she would do like this Vanna White, like, hey, what do you think of this? And it was just like,
I'll have a pee, please.
Take a pee. No, but there was a lady that had a heart attack. And then there was one lady who I saw early on and then literally looked like she had gone swimming. Like her makeup was falling.
Sweat or something?
And then like maybe her Botox was wearing off.
Oh.
So like get so drunk that their face changes. Anyway.
So is that the demographic for you, the Botox years? That's
what I'm looking for, yeah.
No, I meant for the music, not for
you. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I guess it would be 80s, yeah.
Yeah.
But who doesn't
love
the 80s?
Some of them listen to this show. They do.
Oh, really? Oh, they do?
Yeah.
Then we should stop insulting
them. No, I'm not insulting them.
Okay,
I think everyone's aware of what's going on here. And I'm not mentioning any names. I'm like your book.
Yeah, I know, right? We can make up some names.
So you go through the school in North Carolina, bouncer at the bar, quote-unquote bouncer.
Yeah, in fact, it was at that bar on my birthday, which is a couple of days away, like 14 years ago, that I had arranged to meet another law student just before law school. I'd arranged, in 1999, I'd arranged just some girl was coming in with her mom to look at apartments, and I said, hey, meet me at this bar. It's called Top of the Hill. And I said, and she said, well, how will I find you? And we're talking by email. And she said, how do I find you? I said, I'll just go to the bartender. He knows who I am. He'll point you. And she wasn't that impressed by
that's
that.
That's not an impressive thing.
But she came in and came up to the table, and I was actually on a double date with my ex-girlfriend. And this girl walks in, and I just took a look at her. I'm like, oh, my God, that is the most beautiful girl I've ever seen in my life. And I just felt this huge attraction to her. And then turned out to be Sarah.
Wow.
Yeah, she was there with her mum.
Really?
And all the boys actually were hitting on her mum.
Oh, that's good.
In the bar, all these. She was asked to go to some frat party.
How did you work that out? How did you work out getting like her number or anything like that? Like, how does that work out?
Well,
because it's romantic, I'm sure.
I don't think she felt the same way though. She thought it was weird because I was there with my ex.
Yeah, sure, I think it's weird too, but that's cool.
Yeah. Well, and also she had a boyfriend. So what happened was she came down a few months later to start. She did this extra program. She's smarter than I am. She did this international law program, LLM. So she was there through the summer. And I was trying to court her then. But she had another boyfriend. And so she was very, you know.
Standoffish.
Yeah. And he was abroad at the time. And so she was very, you know, unfortunately very well behaved.
Right.
And I remember one time I went out. We all got together at the same bar. There was a group of us from the school. And I ended up going on a date with another girl from that group. And while we were on our date, we ended up at a bar, and then Sarah was there with some other people. And I basically ditched the girl I was with and just spent the whole evening talking to Sarah. It's funny.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's a nice...
You guys have a really cool connection. Plus, there's this one thing I love when you guys are with your kids, because for someone that doesn't have kids, like having three like monkeys, like, you know, going crazy... It would make you nervous, but to watch parents that are really in the zone, like you can carry on a conversation and, you know, keep these guys doing their thing. Both of you can, and I think that's cool.
Yeah, there's a level of ignoring them, I think.
So you guys ended up, how did you end up winning her over? From talking to her that night?
No, I think it was, we became friends, and okay. I'd never done that before. I'd never really been friends with somebody and then dated them. So we were good friends, and I think she realized that her relationship was just heading down the tubes anyway.
No. You were cute.
Naturally.
Good accent.
Yeah. That guy had no chance. And so basically the same weekend, we cut all ties with our exes and said, let's do it. And then got married about a month after 9/11? So.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So we had people cancel coming to the, because we got married in France. So we had people who were too scared to fly and didn't come to the wedding.
So what is it? What's the fascination with France? What's your deal? Because you obviously have an immense love for Paris. Immense.
I do. And really for the whole of France, I think it comes from my childhood. We would, and this is going to sound terrible, but when we were kids, my parents had a chalet in Switzerland. And we would drive down there every...
Why? Because you had an extra house? Vacation house?
Yeah.
That doesn't sound terrible.
Sounds kind of snooty, awesome. Doesn't it? Doesn't
no,
sound...
that's okay. Cool. You got the accent. It works out.
It was wonderful. It was fabulous, of course. And so we would drive down every year. We'd drive through France. And it was always such an adventure going through France. It was always wonderful. Because we'd always stop somewhere. And this was that, you know, you didn't have the internet. You didn't have... we just drive along and mum and dad look at their watch and say, oh, it's time to stop. Let's find a little bed and breakfast or a small hotel in this little town somewhere. Yeah. And it was, you know, even when things went wrong and the food was bad and I had to share a bed with my sister, it was still such an adventure.
Yeah.
And so I think that's where my love of France came in. And, you know, and on school trips, we'd go over there and that was the language that I was taught to speak in England. So, and my mum and dad, when they got back from Africa, that's where they moved to.
Wow.
They went back to England immediately after Africa and then realized what an expensive place it was with crappy weather and generally quite miserable people.
Yeah.
And they, you know, obviously had good experiences with France, so they just rented a house for a year and spent a year looking for the perfect house.
Wow.
And found it, so...
It's amazing.
Yeah, and so it's for me to set my books there is not inevitable, but close to it.
Yeah, that's amazing. So, how did you get to Austin? Where you guys got married, and then where'd you live then?
We were at Duke, and we got lured into working for very big firms. You know, high salaries. We'd been poor students for so long. The lure of a big salary was too much for us. And we decided to come to Dallas actually originally because Sarah's dad was living there and her sister lives nearby in Arlington. So it seemed like a new, exciting place for us.
Sure.
So we went to Dallas. We were there for about 3 years.
How was that?
You know, Dallas is the kind of place, in my opinion, that if you are child-free and have lots of money.
That's fun.
Yeah. Yeah, we did. We had a lot of money. We spent it all. Having fun, you know.
What did you guys do? Did you go see music there? Were you like just
some mostly we bought expensive cars and had ridiculously pricey meals.
That's awesome.
It was fun.
Great restaurants there.
Yeah, and we I think what we did is we got it out of our system.
Yeah,
you know, like I said, we've been poor for a long time.
Yeah,
and we just went just nuts.
Yeah,
and that gives us a very good perspective now.
Were they they were corporate lawyers?
Yes, that's absolutely. Kind of like, yeah, I mean, they were huge offices with big windows.
What do you do in a job like?
I don't really know.
I hate that I'm like in my mid-40s and I have to ask because I have friends that actually do it, but I just never ask what they actually do.
Honestly, I'm not going to tell you because it's not going to be very interesting if I try and tell you.
No, but I mean, like in a day-to-day basis, are you reading stuff and you're signing off on? So you're not. It's not exciting. No one's. You know.
No, you're getting you've got some corporate dispute between two companies and some partner comes to you and says, I need you to research the statute of limitations on
then you do that.
Something or other, and you spend 14 hours reading every case in the world about that,
right?
And then writing a memo, which then it gets ignored. Yeah. It's has no, you know, I was talking before about having to do something where you feel like you are doing something worthwhile.
Yeah.
That wasn't it.
Yeah.
And so after...
Your friends are coming again.
I know, here they are. I think you're actually in you're in the sector that. No, you're south of the river, aren't you? Still,
I'm just south of the river.
Yeah,
you're but just... I mean, this is a pretty loaded street.
Yeah,
with cops, man.
Yeah, just the other side is Charlie Sector up to 12th oh, yeah. and Chicon. That's where I go. That's my area.
I have a friend that has this thing called Spike Club, and I think it's a podcast. And I was just with him yesterday. This guy Jake Flores, he's a comic here.
Okay,
and it's like insult comedy. What's the Swan place there on 12th and Chicon? Something White Swan.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, it's one of those weird places.
Okay,
but I went there once because he did it there. And man, that was.
did you take a bus or drive?
Well, I just remember, you know, because when they first reopened the case, I lived up the street from there, like four blocks
oh, okay.
from there.
Oh wow!
And Detective Walsh called me one time, just out of the blue, and said, "Hey, you don't walk home from downtown, do you?" And I was like, "No." And he's like, "Well, just don't, you know, because this street is." And he kind of told me how they roll you, like they'll drive by and see you,
yeah.
and then a guy will jump out and whatever.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's
so, yeah, it was pretty scary. I can't even remember where I parked, but I remember going like, "What am I doing going to this thing? I'm gonna get killed."
Yeah, it's an interesting, and it's a crazy. I mean, we had a couple weeks ago. There was just some guy lying in the middle of the street, just drunk. I mean, and the thing is that it's a busy intersection, it's, and nobody
really
seemed to care.
Is.
Like if that happened downtown, yeah. somebody would be like, "Oh, we should call the cops," or they'd pick him up and move him to the sidewalk. But out there, it's just another guy in the drunk in the street.
Oh, just the people and what they yell when you're going by
yeah.
and stuff. When you live there, going up that street every day, it was so weird.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting that there's an area like that so close to downtown.
Yeah. So we went off track. Well, you guys were in Dallas. How'd you get here?
I just decided that enough was enough, and all I wanted to do was be a trial lawyer, like
yeah.
not in name like they are up there, but actually get in front of a jury and do that stuff.
Yeah.
So I applied to three different DA's offices and got an interview down here, and then got offered a job, and I sort of said to Sarah, you know, we need to go. And as she's always been, she was like, yeah, all right, you need to do it, let's do it. So it was probably one of the worst times in our marriage, frankly, particularly for her.
Did you have kids? No, you didn't have kids.
We had the twins, and she was pregnant with Nicola.
Okay.
So picture this. We have a combined salary of, what, 250 grand? And we go down to about 60 grand from that. And she's pregnant with our third child.
Wow.
Yeah, it was.
Those are trying times.
They were difficult, but, you know, credit to her and to us, I guess, for getting through them.
Yeah.
Which is why she's demanding a chateau in Paris, by the way, when my books take off.
Yeah, I wouldn't mess with her a lot. That's what I get.
She's
I like her a lot.
Yeah.
She's super cool.
Some people are scared of her sometimes.
I could see.
Yeah.
I have a feeling that maybe I have an in with her and she likes me, so I don't have to worry
no,
about
you're
that.
Safe.
But
yeah.
I could see how I would like to maintain that level of
yeah.
of goodness.
The thing
in her
is,
eyes.
She's very much how she doesn't. She's not. There's no artifice there.
Mm-mm.
Like she will tell you,
mm-hmm.
And that's very refreshing, I think,
yeah.
in somebody.
Yeah.
But that said, I mean. You can't say she's not tolerant, right? I mean, look who she's married to.
Yeah. Well, she seems to have a healthy sense of humor.
Again.
I think that's something that would
yeah.
be a need.
Yeah.
If they're going to live with someone like you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I was married to a lady who did not think that I was funny. Can you imagine how horrible that would be?
No.
I really do. Like, I think I am, and
yeah.
so I'm always going for it. It must have been, like, terrorizing.
And the problem is, if she doesn't think you're funny, you just try harder and harder. Something
gets
worse and worse.
Worse and worse.
Oh, I can't imagine.
So you moved here, and then you got the job at the DA's office.
Yeah.
And has that... You like it there.
They
like you there.
You'd
from
have
what
to,
I've seen.
You have to ask them, but hopefully...
I think the people that I know.
Okay.
I met a friend of yours the other day at a Willie Nelson concert.
Oh, who's that?
She goes out with my... Her name's Michelle.
Michelle,
she
yeah.
goes out with my friend, Kevin.
Yeah. I met her recently. She contacted me, actually, on my author Facebook page or something.
Yeah, she's a fan of yours.
Yeah, she's awesome.
Yeah.
She's a writer, too, you know.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I do.
And a paralegal.
And a paralegal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I like it a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one of those jobs where you feel like you're doing something.
Yeah.
And that's not just getting convictions. I mean, one of the best times I have is when I realize that the person who's charged with something doesn't need to be charged with it. and I can either knock it down or just dismiss it completely.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of discretion we get.
Yeah.
But it's you know, you really feel like you can help either the victim or help some guy turn his life around.
Right.
It's great. Very, very rewarding that way.
You know, I heard this thing. I'd like to get your opinion on it. There was a lady in the news, and they were talking about how they were going to have these real stiff laws for graffiti. You know what I'm talking about? Like a month or so ago.
I didn't hear that.
They're going to crack down on these graffiti guys and put them in jail if they catch them doing graffiti. And then this lady was like, we got to get out of the habit of putting people in jail because we're mad at them and put them in jail because we're afraid of them.
Yeah, I've heard that before.
Yeah.
And I think I agree with that.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, the problem...
How do you differentiate, though?
Yeah, you know I mean? I don't know, because that's fine for us to say. Right? I mean, graffiti makes us mad and we shouldn't put him in jail. But if that's your house that's getting graffitied, you know, yeah. it's the same with drugs and prostitution. You know, people say we shouldn't crack down on that or do anything about that. But, you know, especially now, if you look at that 12th and Chicago area, where you got all these people moving in,
yeah,
paying a lot of money for houses. Yeah. That's their neighborhood. They don't want prostitutes and drug needles and
no,
what have you around there. So,
I wrote a great song about the crack dealers on the corner, or for them. I wrote a jingle for them.
Oh, really?
Yeah, in a songwriting game I had.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll play it. I'll play it on Monday.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'll dedicate it to you.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
12th of Chicago. Running for my friend Mark.
That'll be perfect.
Yeah. So throughout that time, were you writing and creating Hugo Marston?
You know, I wasn't. I'd written two books. I started one when I was up in Dallas, and then another one when I came down here.
What were those kind of books?
The first one was a character I still like the idea of. He was a character whose name was Henry Kendall, and he was an English barrister who had kind of reached his limit, and he'd taken a teaching job in Texas, mm-hmm, at a university teaching law, and he was dragged into a case by circumstance, and he was forced to defend this tramp accused of murder. And it's a story that I haven't gone back and read the manuscript. It's probably horrible, because it didn't get really very much interest from agents or anybody. But I've always liked the idea of people being out of their element,
yeah,
when they have to deal with extreme circumstances. Hugo Marston, for example.
I was going to ask that, yeah, because you're in that same thing, and he's in the same thing too.
Yeah, and I don't know whether it's autobiographical in any way, but Henry Kendall and Hugo Marston are both people who are foreigners, mm-hmm, put in a situation that even back home would be testing.
Yeah,
and I guess Hugo's more of a James Bondian cool guy in a way, so yeah, it's not going to be that big of a deal for him. But so I wrote that book and didn't get any interest, and then I wrote another book which was not intended. It wasn't really even crime fiction, but again, it was about an English lord, a young guy who accidentally shoots somebody during a pheasant hunt, and his dad sends him off to America, and he is
like to hide out.
No, just to get him away, because the stupid kid keeps messing up. But the reason he keeps messing up is because he has Asperger's and nobody really knows it.
Oh.
So he's very sensitive, but he's also very plain spoken and very literal.
Right.
And you can imagine having an English character in, again, Texas,
yeah,
being very literal,
yeah,
that could get you into all kinds of trouble. Yeah. And again, that book got a little bit more interest from agents, but not enough to where I got representation.
What kind of feedback were you getting back? What were they saying, stuff like
that? You know, they don't really give feedback other than some standard letter saying, thanks
at
for...
At this point, we don't want to do this.
This is not right for our list, sort of thing.
In the music business, they're much harsher.
This is crap. Don't bother me again.
No, they're like, you know, I've been told stuff like, I know what you think you're doing is like a sound, and it's your signature, but it's just redundant and things like that, you know?
Wow.
Like,
that's harsh.
Yeah. Gosh. So they're not that harsh in the world?
No. I mean, I think partly because, you know, the good agents, they get...
Is that how you send it to agents, not...
Right. The way it works is you finish your manuscript and then you send it's called a query letter. So it's like a one-page letter describing the project.
It's just kind of gay.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, not very, just query.
It's query.
We're not allowed to make those jokes anymore. And you send that to the agent, and if the agent likes the look of, she likes, he or she likes the letter, and they're, oh, the guy can write a letter, that's a good start.
Oh, that's good.
And they like the story, yeah. Then they'll say, send me the first three chapters. If they like the first three chapters, then they'll say, send me the whole thing. And then yeah. If they like the whole thing, they'll offer to represent you.
Yeah.
But each agent will get between 100 and 500 query letters a week. So they don't have time to give any kind of feedback. They're right. Just like, bugger off, bugger off, bugger off. First chapter, bugger off. And they, right. They'll say on their websites, here, we reject 99% of everything we see.
Wow.
So it's not a great shock when you get rejected, but it's still...
still kind of like, oh.
After 25 yeah. of them, it's like, good grief.
Yeah. Yeah, it gets old.
But I got more immediate and more interest with a bookseller straight away.
Right.
I didn't... You know, for the other books, I probably sent out 50, 60 queries to different agents and got nothing. For the bookseller, I sent out a total of 15, I think, and at least five of them showed interest. And then,
when you do that, do you have to write like a when you say you write like a pitch letter?
Yeah, that's like, exactly right. That's exactly what it is—a pitch letter.
CIA agent takes job in Paris.
Yeah, but the book has to lay out the story, and it has to be written in the tone of the story.
Okay.
It has to be original enough so. The agent could be like, oh, this is different,
right?
And this guy can write, so let me have a look at it.
Okay.
So it's honestly, writing those query letters is kind of an art in itself, and there are sure. websites devoted to how to do it.
It's
I always think there are probably a lot of very good writers who just can't do that, and so they don't get anywhere.
Yeah.
But
and so your agent, is it she connected with it?
She connected with it pretty quickly, and I had some other agents from pretty big agencies who kept saying, give me some more time to read it. I really like what I've read so far. Give me a bit more time. But she was so enthusiastic, and she works for a very well-respected agency in Boston. She called me, and I was at some crappy restaurant on the way down to Houston to do I don't even know what.
Go see the Astros. No, I'm just joking.
No, I'm wondering whether it was after I'd just gotten your mum's case,
and you were going down there with Tom.
I went down with Sarah.
Oh, with Sarah
to visit the grave.
Oh, wow.
And it may have been that trip.
That's weird. That's very heavy. That's a weird connection. That
it would have been in October too that I got the call from my agent. But anyway, on a happy note,
it was
thrilling. It was fantastic. We could have been going down to see the Black Keys. I don't remember.
Are you a Black Keys fan?
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Me too.
And so from there, you know, my agent, she helped me work, kind of knock the front end of the book off because it was a bit slow.
Mm-hmm.
And then she spent a year
shopping it around.
That's when we got close. You get comments, you get feedback from the publishers.
Yeah.
Because she'll basically do to them what I did to her, which is send out the book and say, here's the author, here's the story, what do you think?
Yeah.
And a lot of them read the book and were like, oh, it's great, love the character, the setting is amazing, you can feel like you're in Paris.
Yeah.
The action is really good.
Yeah.
But we're going to pass, thank you very much. And it's like, excuse me? Why?
Yeah.
But I think as a new author, it's kind of hard to...
Sure.
Get cracking, but
especially in a world in same thing in music, there's a declining sales,
and people are going with the authors that they know will sell.
There's already enough authors out there that have proven themselves that it is difficult to sneak in.
Or they're going with the celebrities who are writing their biographies,
right? Yeah, which there's everybody's doing that for the last couple of years.
I felt quite lucky to, I think it was the same day I got three different publishers made offers on the same day.
Yeah.
And then one of them obviously wanted a three-book deal, so...
Yeah.
We went with that, obviously.
So, man, now it's kind of this montage, you know, for the last few months. Like, if it was a movie of your life, this would be the part where it's like the montage thing where they play a song and you're doing an interview here and signing a book there and speaking at a thing there. You're doing a lot of that stuff right now. Is that... awesome.
It's amazing. You know, my ambition was always, it was sort of incremental. It was, first of all, if I can just get an agent, then that'll be validation enough for my writing. if I can just, and I've got an agent, if I can just get just one book published, that's all I need, and yeah. I'll be happy. And now, I've stopped limiting myself.
Yeah, now you're like,
I'm not. You know, someone said something. Another writer said something to me. She said, because we were at a talk together, and somebody asked for advice, and she said, "This, if you're coming up, if you're a new writer, you have hopes and expectations, but you need to package them separately." Because your hopes and your expectations are probably not going to line up.
Right.
It's okay to have both.
Yeah.
But make sure you treat them very differently. And my expectations, I was always limiting myself. And now I don't. I'm like, whatever happens, happens.
Yeah.
I know that there's interest from my publisher in continuing the Hugo Marston series beyond the three books that we have a deal for.
Yeah.
It's now sold in 7 countries.
Yeah, I saw that. It's in Portuguese.
It's in Portuguese, it's yeah. in Japanese, Italian,
but
Czech,
but that's so exciting. I'm
Hungarian.
I'm so proud of you. Like, that's so exciting.
Well, the funny thing is, you know, when I got my deal with my American publisher, they send me a certain number of copies, 25 copies, for me to do with whatever I like.
Right.
And so they do the same with the foreign ones, and I got the Japanese contract, and I was going through it with Sarah, because she's a very detail-oriented lawyer.
I thought you were saying, because she was secretly Japanese.
she's actually turning Japanese. I really think so. Yeah. So we were going through it, and I was like, oh, look, they'd only given me 5 copies of the book. And she looks at me, and she goes, what the hell do you want with a book in Japanese?
Well, yeah, I'd want a bunch of them, too.
I would want, yeah, yeah. I think it really...
Show your friends, and they come over for dinner.
I don't know any Japanese people. I have one friend. I have a very good friend at work who's Portuguese, and so I very proudly presented him with a copy of the book.
Was he happy?
Yeah, yeah, he was thrilled. And I heard last week it's going to come out in Brazil too now.
Wow!
So I'm assuming it's going to be like the same cover, but the guy's going to be wearing a thong on the front.
That's awesome.
And I want lots of copies of that.
I like the cover for the Portuguese one.
It's really cool.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah, most other countries like Italy did pretty much the same thing, but just changed the font on the title. But yeah, that's the thing. Somebody said there's no such thing as free money. Well, I can tell you there is when it comes to writing books, because the book's already done.
Yeah,
and for the foreign versions, I don't have to do anything except sign the contract, and that's free money.
Do you know? I mean, isn't that weird that there's a guy sitting there translating all your stuff?
Yeah, and they don't tell me when it's going to come out. I didn't know that the Italian one were going to come out until a journalist from Italy contacted me for an interview, and I was like, oh, okay, yeah. When's the book coming? She goes, it's coming out on Wednesday. And I was like, oh, okay, I didn't know that.
Wow.
But
there's so much stuff going on, you don't even know.
Yeah, yeah. Or I'm not important enough to tell.
Right. Are you gonna go and do some signings and stuff? You have a big thing on May 19th, and Well, you're going to understand, but that's my grandma's 90th birthday party.
Oh,
and her 90th birthday.
Okay.
So I won't be there.
Okay.
I'll be in Houston.
Yeah, I'll forgive
Sorry.
You for that. No,
yeah,
no, no.
Yeah.
Just as long as you give her a kiss and a hug for me, then it's
I will.
Okay.
I'll give her a book.
You know what? If I'd known that, I would have bought a copy for her.
Did they ever, has anyone ever talked about a movie? Like a little... I bet you've got that in your mind.
No, I do. People are always asking me who would play who. I do have somebody, an agent for a big Hollywood firm. I think I can talk about this, I guess. Why not? Who is representing the book.
Fantastic.
There was a producer guy. I don't know who. I don't know what company. He contacted my literary agent, and she said, well, yes, we have the film rights, but I don't do that stuff. So she contacted somebody she knows at United Talent and said, would you represent the book? And this agent said, well, let me see it first. And so she read it over the weekend and was like, I'll represent it.
It's good. It feels like it could
It's very visual, I think.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's not a lot of fluffy description.
And I mean, even if they had like, I think there's even enough action to suffice it being like an exciting action film. The way that you write it is exciting.
Well, thank you. You know what I would like? What would be great fun would be to have like an HBO series or a BBC series or something.
Oh, yeah.
With him as
that
a...
would
I mean,
be awesome.
You could
yeah.
see him as a recurring character, especially if I have another book deal coming
sure.
through.
Oh, right. I was thinking more of like even a James Bond thing.
Yeah. I mean, like, he could be the American James Bond, right?
American James Bond.
It's perfect.
Yeah. He could do better than Flint. Did you ever see those movies?
No.
Oh, James Coburn is James Bond. No. I mean, he's as like a James Bond kind of guy.
Oh, really? James Coburn?
Yeah. He's unbelievable. He kicks more ass and gets more chicks.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
It's not about amount, though. It's about quality.
Oh, they're good.
Okay.
He wasn't. James Coburn's good, man.
Yeah.
What about, are they going to make As She Lay Sleeping the movie?
I don't know. Although, I don't know if you noticed that we had when they had the Discovery ID did their show, everybody had a character playing them except me.
Yeah.
I was really fun about it.
I didn't see that show, but I heard someone was like, oh, and you're making out with a chick, and it's like some guy playing you.
Yeah.
Was he cool?
Not it's going to be as cool as you, but...
But
yeah, I mean, it was cool because whoever has an actor playing...
dramatic reenactments.
No, I mean, it's tremendously cheesy.
Yeah.
But
I
you know
only
that,
imagine.
You know that going in. You know it's going to be.
Yeah.
But I don't know if they'll make a movie of it. Again, somebody had contacted I have a different agent for that book, and somebody had contacted him and said, just asked about the movie rights.
I should get that shit. I'm just...
Who would you play?
I don't want to be in it.
You don't want to... You can be an actor.
You're an actor. Yeah, I can narrate it.
Yeah. That wouldn't be weird at all, would it?
Yeah, Jesus. I wasn't going to read it, not out of any kind of boycotting
right. You
or the idea of it. It's just I've lived it.
I would have thought you'd have enough.
I did. That was enough. But there was some things I was like, you know, I flipped through, I saw the pictures, and I saw some like the note. I'd never seen the note that Dennis left my mom or anything like that.
Oh, okay.
Like physically, I'd never seen it.
Because I forget that you weren't in there for the whole trial.
And back to the Crypt Thief. Is Claudia back?
She is.
Okay.
She is. You know, she's one of the characters they got the most feedback on.
Yeah?
Because I realized afterwards I don't have very many female characters
mm-hmm.
in my books.
Yeah.
And I want to change that. But I don't want the screaming victim.
No. Cool chick.
Yeah. And in fact, in the Crypt Thief, my local librarian where I write these books, she's a big fan and a very plain-spoken woman.
Mm-hmm.
And she told me that in the bookseller, she thought maybe Claudia at the end was a little bit not strong enough.
I was just thinking, like, now you got that person. You got the library. Do you know Mark?
I know, right?
She got a little...
yeah, yeah.
She got a little talky at the end there, buddy.
Hey, I'll take input from anywhere. But in the Crypt Thief, she comes back and she's... I wouldn't say she saves the day, but pretty close.
Yeah.
So... And I want her to be a continuing character. Now there is a new character I'm bringing in that I hope that I haven't seen done a lot in fiction, and that's a transsexual.
Awesome!
Yeah,
finally the trannies.
I know, right? It's going to be a transsexual police officer.
Only in Paris.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it works quite well. I'm not trying to make a big deal out of it, but you know, writers, you know, we sort of strive for originality,
right.
And reality.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of people around,
yeah.
And who don't have a voice, who don't appear in fiction. It's always the big handsome dude who I've got, you know, the hot chick who I've got.
Yeah.
Well, how about the male to female transsexual cop?
Of course, where's that guy
in
the book?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So
where's my tranny cop?
So, and she's going to be cool too. She's not going to be some. Yeah. Hopefully, it's a realistic portrayal. And doesn't harp on about it and make a big deal of it, but just incorporates her into the story as a relevant and meaningful character. We will see.
Yeah. And this book comes out May 7th, which is the day that this interview will come out.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Excellent.
Tuesday.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, people might be listening to it further down the line. People can find it at Amazon, your local bookstore, if there is such a thing as a bookstore anymore.
Yeah.
Went to the gallery in Houston... looking for a bookstore, and I walked and walked and couldn't find it anywhere. So finally I just asked someone, like, hey, where's the bookstore? I was like, oh, there's not one here anymore.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah, giant mall.
And if you go to Book People here in Austin, it's packed. I mean,
that's
it's all the
best
time.
Place, yeah.
It's a great bookstore.
And they support you, and you have a thing there May 19th.
May 19th, 5 p.m. It's Sunday.
5 p.m. Sunday.
Yeah. And, oh, here's a very important thing,
yeah,
Johnny.
Yeah, please.
What I'm going to do, because I always worry about, I don't like reading from my own book.
No.
I don't like doing, yeah. So what I'm going to do, but I've already had a talk about writing and publishing and stuff, so I was thinking, what do I do? So what I'm going to do, I'm going to literally have a hat, like the kind of hat Hugo would wear. I'm going to pass it around, and if you're interested and if you want to do this, all you have to do is write your name on a piece of paper, and I'm going to pull two or three, I haven't decided, and those names will become characters. So it's kind of a raffle to have your name be a character.
Wow.
Not a huge character, maybe, no, and then I could kill you in some horrible way or make you a horrible person.
Oh, I want to do that. Even if I'm out there, could I email the name to somebody?
If there's a couple of bucks attached to it, maybe.
Well, yeah, when I first thought you said, what I'm going to do is I'm going to pass the hat at my reading party.
Because everyone's so cheap, they won't buy a book.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Hey, go ahead. Just, you know, throw in what you want.
Isn't that a fun idea? Just to
that's a great idea. Have,
and then I've written out because I'm a lawyer, right? I'm terrified that someone's going to sue me down the line when I kill
You've
them.
I've written out a
disclaimer. But it's a humorous one. I wish I had brought it with me that I could read it. But it's a funny one. It's like, you know, you understand that I could do all these gross things to you or make you a horrible, you know.
Right.
So I want to have whoever wins sign that.
You know what else we need to talk about is DA Confidential, your blog.
Yes.
Which I've always found incredibly entertaining. And that's why I read about you getting in that weird thing with that guy that got in the wreck last year.
Which was
Remember?
That?
Whatever weird thing happened when the guy was with you in the car or next to you in the
car. Yeah.
And you didn't know if he was being mean or having some kind of seizure.
And turned out he had some kind of seizure. It was up in Dallas. He just drew up next to us and was screaming at us in his SUV, and we were in ours, and he just slammed into us. And then he kept going through a hedge, across a parking lot, into the side of a building. And his car was on fire. It was crazy.
It's insane.
Yeah. Yeah, I went over to punch his lights out and ended up pulling him out of the damn car.
Have you ever had to be in a fight?
No.
That's good.
No, I really
haven't. That's good, because you have a kind heart. Seems like something that would probably just bother you if you had to do that.
Yeah.
Like it would bother you inside.
Yeah, I'm not.
You're not aggressive.
I'm not an aggressive person.
And you're not a rager?
No. No. Usually I would just walk away.
Right.
Or just insult somebody horribly. But I'm not.
In a condescending way.
Yeah, exactly.
I saw you do that in court during my mom's trial.
Oh, did I?
Sometimes you had a couple of good little...
Yeah.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah.
That's what you do. Oh, English and snooty.
Well,
awesome.
I'm not allowed to punch people in court. So.
No. What was the heavy metal... Remember the heavy metal guy? What was the name of his band? Like,
Stryker.
Stryker, that's right. God, that was so funny to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
I couldn't believe that. Like, I couldn't believe that was an aspect of it.
See, that's another one of these bizarre characters. I mean, here he is. I don't know what he does now, like sells insurance or something with his polo shirt and his khakis. And then he's got these pictures of him when he was 20s as a Christian rock Kiss-like. It was unbelievable.
Well, the worst part about it is they were a ripoff of Stryper, right? Didn't they have to change their name because it was too close or something?
Yeah, something like that.
Stupid. Let me ask you this, and then I'll let you go. When we both were on 48 Hours, do you get emails after it airs? Like, do people go to your Facebook and write you stuff or find you places?
No.
No?
No, I did. I mean, I read the Facebook posts on the 48 Hours site after that, but no one's ever...
That was weird, wasn't it? Did you read it, like, right after it happened?
Yeah, oh, yeah. Yeah, and you know what I wanted to do, and I tell people this now, because people will say to me, hey, I saw you on TV.
Right.
And so I isolate the show. I figure out which one it was.
Right.
Because the Discovery one was more pro us.
Do you go, I was riding a horse.
Yeah,
was I riding a horse?
Yeah, exactly.
Was I not?
Was that me on the horse or not? And if it was, I tell them, look, first thing you need to know is we had way more evidence than they showed on that show.
I know, that I have to do that too.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons I wrote that book, because...
I'm glad that you did.
Because I actually had someone tell me, I saw the 48 Hour show and I wondered. And then I read your book and I was like, oh, okay,
right.
Now I get it.
Yeah, Mark Hallman actually yesterday said that he wanted to read this book.
Yeah.
Not because of anything, but because he feels like there's so much he doesn't know that went on.
Yeah, and I think the book is a pretty accurate, I hope it's pretty accurate and fair about what happened, and contains pretty much all of the evidence.
Has anyone come up and complained? I mean, has anyone been like, hey, what were you talking about?
No, but I haven't run into the defense lawyer yet.
No. I run into him.
Oh, you do? Wade?
Yeah, I've run into him at parties all the time.
Okay.
Not like parties where my friends are, but like a show, you know, music industry.
Yeah, but he's always been super nice and...
Yeah, he's real nice. I always like people introduce me to him. Like, hey, Johnny, do you know Wayne? And like, yeah, we actually do know each other.
Cross-examine me.
Exactly. Cool. But what, I mean, you know, I can't... It's weird because I don't ever want to seem callous where, like, I don't have feelings, but I understand everybody has a job to do.
Yeah.
And that in anything, there's going to be a defense attorney, and that guy's obviously going to be trying to get that guy off. That guy never insulted me. He always treated me with a lot of respect and never tried to make me look any way, or my mom in any way.
Right.
So what am I, you know?
No, and that's the right attitude to have, because he is literally doing a job.
He's just doing a job.
It's a very, very difficult. I mean, those guys come into... I have a friend who's a defense, who is a prosecutor. Then he went to be a defense lawyer, and now he's a prosecutor again. And he said, you know, and you should see the difference in people's reactions when I meet them at a dinner party between being a prosecutor and a criminal defense lawyer.
Yeah.
It's like, a criminal defense lawyer, they don't want to have anything to do with me.
No. It's like being a dentist.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. A kid's dentist.
Ooh.
Yeah, see?
Ooh. You got a good dentist here in town?
I'm looking for one down south, if you have any recommendations.
I got a guy, he's up north, but he's amazing. Best guy. Been really? Going to him for now for 20 years.
Really?
No, 19 years.
Plus, yeah. I'm English. We don't really do dentists.
Right, right. So. But he's also a big fan. Like, if you're in the chair, you might hear one of my jams.
Really?
Uh-huh. And it's not even my, as long as they don't have bad words, I take out the songs. I do. I take out the songs with explicit lyrics and make him a copy with just the regular ones. I can put them in his iTunes. Yeah. So The Crypt Thief. Man, 3 books in 1 year. I mean, do you know anybody else who does that?
No. No, and I'm going to slow down a bit, I think.
You're going to...
I don't have to.
You're getting to hang out with a lot of other writers?
Yeah.
That day we went to that thing, that was cool.
Yeah.
I want to hang out with more guys like that.
Yeah, I met a guy called Philip Kerr, who's like a superstar. He's written 20 books, and the guy who runs Book People now takes me along. He has me, introduces me. Yeah, and so I went and had dinner and then went back to the guy's hotel and had drinks with him. And this is the guy who sells millions and millions and millions of books. But, of course, nobody – he's a famous author, right, which means nobody knows who he is.
Right.
Which is sort of funny, but that's the best kind of fame, I suppose.
Do you have a Kindle?
I do.
You don't mind if we don't stop yet, do you?
No, no.
Okay, good.
No.
I like talking to you.
Yeah, no, I do, but I don't use it.
You don't use it?
You know why?
Why?
My wife bought it for me because I wanted it, because I like, you know, you can download books really easy and it's great. But sometimes we'll lie in bed and we'll read next to each other.
Oh. Right?
And so I'm sitting there reading, it's completely quiet, and then there's click.
Yeah. Oh.
You know, every click.
Yeah.
And she's like, God. So it's a Kindle. And it makes more noise than a book, or a more annoying noise, apparently. So I've gone back to real books.
I like a book.
Yeah.
I mean, it's weird to say. I was thinking about getting an iPad, and I was like, because I love reading magazines, but I actually like reading. I like it. I guess I have to let go of that. Do you?
No, I don't think you have to. I mean, I like to have shelves full of books.
Yeah.
You can't do that with the Kindle. But on the other hand, the Kindle's great for travel. You don't have to pack 17 books in your bag. You can just take your Kindle and download.
Let me ask you a question that I bet is on a lot of people's minds right now. Not, but mine.
That's enough.
The pay, because the price of a Kindle book, the price of an audio book, and the price of a physical book are extremely different.
Right.
Or the difference between a physical and a non-physical book because of that. Do you still get a similar cut?
I actually get a much better royalty off the Kindle. Hmm. Yeah, that's much better for me.
Do your publishers, do they ever talk about, like, I mean, do you know if you sell more electronically than you do physically?
I know that I sell at least twice as many electronic as I do.
Shit, I didn't realize it was like that.
And for some people, it's 3 times. And I haven't had my first royalty statement yet.
Yeah.
It's due any day. So when I get that, I'm going to be fascinated to see what the ratio is.
Yeah.
Because generally, I'm told for crime fiction, it's 2 or 3 times as many electronic as for every hard copy.
Yeah.
And I know I'm selling hard copies pretty well, so...
Are you?
Yeah, apparently. Yeah, the first... They did an initial print run, and within a week or 2 weeks, they had to do another print run, so...
So does that mean you went in the black?
You think? By now I will have. Whether my first royalty...
God, it must be a great feeling. Nobody lost their ass on you either?
Yet.
Dude, people have lost so much money on me in my career that I'm always like... there's some people I see, even Mark Holman, where I'm like, sorry about that record we made in 1994 that you did on spec that didn't sell at all, bro.
But that's the big fear. But the problem is I have that fear every time a book comes out. like with the Crypt Thief, I know, fortunately, I think it's going to be okay because I'm getting some good reviews.
Yeah.
But now I've just finished the third book. Literally, it's sitting at home. I'm editing it. And I sent it to my first person. I have a couple people who read for me before I give it to my editor. And I'm sending it off and I'm thinking, oh, God, what if it's complete crap? You know,
there's pressure. Now you got to live up to
that's
something.
The thing. This is the first book there's ever been pressure on me and that I've been required to write. The first two I kind of wrote for myself, and if they didn't see the light of day, no big deal. But now there's people waiting for this one. People have already paid for it.
I think that's cool, man.
See, that's the thing. I always remind myself.
What a great problem to have.
Like 2 years ago, I would have given my left arm to have this problem.
I remember. I mean, I remember when you were, even before you got the thing. I mean, you were just like, man, I'm trying to get this done. Yeah. I'm trying to send it out to everyone I can.
That was when we went to the book festival. Yeah, yeah. I was in that situation. And now, you know, I've got, I'm going to have 4 books published by the end of the year. And
you're going to be in the book festival this year, you think? Were you there last year?
I was not last year. I know my publicist has contacted them and is seeing if I can get on one of the panels. That would be fun. I would like to.
Yeah.
I would like to. Yeah.
How's the audiobook sales?
It just came out in audio.
Yeah?
And I'm pretty excited because I have a friend of my grandparents who's blind and lives in North Carolina. And she's...
Oh, cool.
She's got to be 100 and something by now, but she's still alive and well. And so
she's gonna get to hear it.
I'm gonna send her a copy of an audio copy of the book.
That is awesome.
And I haven't even heard it myself yet. I think it's good. I think it would be weird, but
it'd be cool.
It's cool.
I remember both you and Bruce. I couldn't understand why. I mean, you, I understand because this guy's supposed to be American and all that stuff. But you do. You're cool. But Bruce has like a weird way that he reads when he reads. Like he has this character he reads as.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he has a weird accent and stuff. It's awesome.
Yeah, well, I'm curious to hear it, I suppose, because I have French people and Americans, and then I have
And they speak, you know,
Americans speak in French.
Yeah.
So we'll see. I'll have to listen and see how that turns out.
What about Tom Green? Is he back?
He is back.
The gang's back.
He's back, and he's going to be fighting his alcohol problem.
Yeah.
And he's going to be giving in to his prostitute problem.
That's a good thing.
I think so.
So there's going to be some more sex for me in this book. They're in a little stuff for my.
I don't think there is. It's exciting. It's a little darker. The Crypt Thief is a little darker than the Bookseller. The Bookseller is more of a classic mystery in some ways.
Right.
The Crypt Thief is more of a. It's darker and it's more thriller-esque, I think, in some ways.
Do you feel like maybe? Oh, I got a great question. I was going to ask you when you first walked in. I said, "Save it to the thing." Say, remember this, Johnny. Okay. Do you do you feel like someone has to read the book, should read the Bookseller definitely before they read The Crypt Thief?
Actually, no. I've been asked that question a few times, and I'm trying to write each one so that no matter which one you pick up in the series, it's you'll be fine. I reintroduce Tom and Claudia and how they met, that kind of stuff. I'll do that in each book. Now, would I like you to? Yeah, because, you know.
It's easier.
It's easier. And also what I'm trying to do is have characters... not just reoccur, but make references to things that happen in other books.
Yeah.
So that if you pick up The Crypt Thief and you read that one first, it's not going to be a big, you're not going to miss anything.
Yeah.
But you might get a little bit more if you've read the Bookseller first.
Say this keeps on going and you keep on writing books about Hugo Marston. Do you go back and do a prequel, kind of? Like what it was like when he was in the CIA, what he was like?
Funny you should ask that.
Yeah. That's the question I had at the door.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm writing some more Hugo Marston's, okay. and should I get a deal with my publisher, one of them is going to be set in London, when Hugo is, he still works for the State Department, but it's going to be before his Paris.
Okay.
Yeah. And in that book, he's going to meet Max, the bookseller, for the first time.
Right.
So that'll be the prequel. I hadn't thought about going further back than that. But yeah, that's going to be a prequel, and then I'm hoping to. My editor has told me that I can move him around Europe, so he doesn't have to be set in Paris every time. So we're going to have London, and then I literally sat down with Sarah and I said, "Where do you want to go?" Because wherever Hugo goes,
you guys have to go to check it out.
Exactly.
Oh, that's cool.
It's another tough problem to have.
Don't you guys need a Manny?
I did tell Sarah that we, I told her, I said we do need a Swedish au pair.
Oh, yeah.
And you know what she said?
What?
She said, that's absolutely fine, as long as you let me choose him.
Oh, yeah. I got a friend that's a Manny and a comedian.
Really?
Yeah.
That sounds like a really good mix, actually. Yeah. For my family, it sounds perfect.
It actually probably would be.
Huh.
But I think he's already got a family.
Really?
He does great stuff, material about it on stage.
Oh, I
really
bet.
Does.
I hope he changes really the names. Funny.
He does.
Yeah.
And he says it the whole time. He's like, I have to change their names. Yeah.
Yeah. No, we their kids are getting old enough now that they can travel without causing us too much grief, I think.
Yeah. What a great thing, Mark. I'm so proud of you, and I'm really happy for you. I think this is really great. I can't tell you this. I mean, like, there didn't used to be three books right here like a year ago.
I know.
And now there are.
Like, yeah.
You are literally creating so much.
Yeah.
And making stuff where there once was nothing.
Yeah, and it's astounding to me because I still don't feel like a writer. You know, I wrote for 10 years before anything got published, and
yeah.
I would never have dared call myself a writer.
Yeah, and now you can.
Now I can say not only am I a writer, but I'm an author.
Yeah.
It sounds kind of pretentious to me still, but there you have it. That's what
I am.
You
got a real book, you got fiction books, you're just whatever.
Yeah.
It's me. Ride around with cops on Thursdays.
I know, I need a rest.
Yeah. You sounded so defeated when you said that.
You made me realize how much I do. But
do you wear a Kevlar vest?
You know, I don't. Nights? I don't. And
I want you to.
One of the my wife does too.
Yeah.
And one of the cops brought that up, and he's like, "You should get one." I'm like, "No, dude, you should provide me with one."
They should.
What I do, I always buy them dinner, and they're very grateful. And I say, "No, don't be grateful. Just jump in front of a bullet if it comes my way." So.
Then they start asking you to take them to nicer places.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. If I'm taking bullets, we're going somewhere else.
Yeah. Okay. So May 7th, people can find The Crypt Thief. I almost said The Crypt Keeper. Has anyone said that yet?
No, not yet.
Okay. Well, I win.
I've had some people say The Book Thief, though.
That would be really awesome. And you know what I was thinking, too? If they ever get one of the guys, like you could make one of the bad guys snatching up the Nazi chasers have the Nazi mustache from the school.
Yeah. Did I tell you what that guy's name was?
No.
It was Mr. Herbert Flowers.
That is amazing.
Isn't it?
Yeah. That is a great name.
Yeah.
So, do you send this stuff to your old teachers?
I'm not sure most of them can read. Well, most of them are dead, I'm sure. That was a long time ago.
Oh, yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
There's a fourth grade teacher that I still am waiting. I'm waiting for this podcast to generate an incredible amount of revenue.
Right.
So I could write her a letter that says, yes, I can make a living just talking. She always used to say, I'll never make a living just talking.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
John, you're never going to make a living just talking.
I hope it works for you.
Yeah, I hope so too. Having you on the show has been great, Mark. Thank you for coming. I think the world of you. You're a great guy that's not only cool and a great author, but you changed my life in a great way, and I'll always think highly of you.
Well,
unless you mean me.
I better change that name in the book then.
Yeah.
Thank you, Johnny.
Thank you so much. All right. Yeah. My friend and one of my true heroes, Mark Pryor. I'm really proud of him for all of his success. Under 1 year, he's released three books. That's amazing. That is an amazing feat, especially in this day and age. Hopefully, they'll all be successful. Go out and get The Crypt Thief. It's out. Read The Bookseller. They're great books. Hugo Marston is a good hero for the future. So I wish him all the luck in the world. He's got a beautiful family, and I look forward to hanging with him again soon. Thank you for listening. I really appreciate it. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes if you have not done this. Go there, subscribe, and it helps us and is going to help keep this show free for a long time. If you rate us and leave a comment, it helps with our overall rating on iTunes, which is going to help us get the good advertisers to keep this show free for you. Like our Facebook page, How Did I Get Here? Follow me on Twitter and Instagram. I am at Johnny Gowdy. I post pictures. All right? Thanks again to Mark Pryor. All right? And have a great, great, great day. Bye-bye. Before